Hello, welcome to the Law Report. Damien Carrick with you. Today, regulating the troubled New South Wales tattoo industry.
Police say a man wearing a ski mask walked into the tattoo parlour at about 8:30. A short time later, there was an explosion inside the building.
Police hope that releasing security camera vision will help them catch the people who attacked a Western Sydney tattoo parlour.
Not linked to three other shootings in the same number of hours overnight at a house and tattoo parlour at Merrylands and Tattoo World at Baulkham Hills. The attack at that tattoo shop was the third in just over a year.
Back in 2012, the New South Wales government wanted to clean up the tattoo industry. Concerned about the influence of outlaw motorcycle gangs and acts of violence such as shootings and firebombings, the state government introduced a new licensing system. It requires all operators of tattoo parlours and all tattoo artists who work in those businesses to pass a fit and proper person test. Jeremy Maspero, a partner with Maspero Legal, says this licensing system and its use of secret evidence has led to an unfair outcome for one of his clients.
So he is in his mid-60s and he's basically been a tattoo artist for almost all of his adult life, not only in Sydney but actually all around the world, running a whole range of tattoo parlours from small ones to very large ones, employing more than 15 to 20 staff.
He's been involved in this industry for many years, but that was only until last month. What happened last month?
Due to the legislation that was introduced in late 2012, the Tattoo Parlours Act, which was aimed at basically ridding bikies and organised crime from the tattoo industry, our client was forced to reapply for his licence. So, long story short, last month he received an outcome of that application, which was he wasn't a fit and proper person, he wasn't allowed to remain in the industry, and he had to basically sell or get out of his current business.
Okay, on what information is this fit and proper person test decided?
It was a number of things. It was based on his criminal history, which they looked back as far as 1985. Now, usually a spent conviction usually means that after, I think it's 10 years, your criminal record is no longer valid, but this act overrode that. So on one hand, the authorities went back his entire life, his adult life, and looked at his criminal record.
Does he have serious offences?
Not really. I mean, it's driving offences, drink driving, driving without a licence, speeding, you know, some things we've probably all done at some point in our life, but not serious, especially when compared to some other decisions that have been made under this legislation.
So only driving offences, nothing which goes to, if you like, criminal organisations
or
violence offences?
There was, see, one part of it wasn't even, because, I mean, our client has really had the book thrown at him, and there was even an alleged incident in there, and that incident didn't go to court. It was basically dropped at a very early stage. So, you know, whilst it's on his record, it's not actually a proven offence.
Does your client have any connection with outlaw motorcycle gangs?
Absolutely not. He's just was a hardworking man in a very busy tattoo parlour, which unfortunately is an industry where there are lots of organised criminals. But our client certainly is not.
Was there any relationship between his business and organised motorcycle gangs?
Part of the brief of evidence which we were able to look at, because another part of it we weren't able to, which I can talk to you about, it was alleged that his current partner used to date a member of a motorcycle gang, but that was quite some time ago, and our client has nothing to do with that person. But that was part of the brief of evidence, as well as a number of other things which move into the, you know, the secret redacted evidence which we were not able to look at.
And that's really the issue, yes, as you see it. The most important issue, yes, in this process is, mm-hmm, this use of redacted or secret evidence in a determination about whether or not somebody is a fit and proper person.
Yes.
What is the issue as you see it?
Firstly, going back to what a fit and proper person is, I mean, I would say that they've applied the wrong test. I mean, if you think about what a tattoo artist does. I mean, they're sitting there tattooing people. They're using creative artwork and things like that. So when you look at a fit and proper person, you would think that a test being involved would be their ability to do that, you know, not something like a driving record or an alleged incident over 15 years ago involving violence. So that's the first thing that we really disagree with. And secondly, really, this redacted evidence, which is included in other sorts of legislation as well, is really just appalling. What it's doing is it's circumventing the judicial system. It really is a one-way street. There's no mechanism to challenge it.
Okay, so how does this process work? The police provide evidence to what?
Yes.
The Office of Fair Trade, who run mm-hmm. this system. Then the Office of Fair Trade make a determination whether somebody is or isn't a fit and proper person.
Yes.
And then tell you the decision, but yes. not the information upon which yes. the decision was made. Is that, as you see it, the issue here?
Yes, exactly. So basically, we were handed a brief as part of the decisioning, and there's entire pages of this brief which really go to the core of the decision. So this fit and proper person character test. So there's entire pages of this brief which are blacked out and we're not able to look at and not able to challenge. And I mean, if you think of the criminal law system in itself and having that right to look at evidence, because let's face it, quite often evidence is not good evidence. It's bad evidence or it's not even relevant.
So you're saying that you can't contest the evidence, you can't refute the evidence because you don't know what it is?
No, and there's a really heavy burden that's placed on us because effectively what we're doing is we're challenging evidence which is virtually impossible to obtain.
Presumably it may relate to your client's spouse's former relationship mm-hmm. with a member of a gang, and that may be something you could have anticipated and responded to?
Well, not necessarily, because when you have entire pages of a brief blacked out, I mean, how on earth do you make that assumption and assume that? I mean, there is one thing in this brief where they talk about, and it's years ago, it was more than 5 years ago, the authorities went out onto the premises to do a routine check, which a bit like licensing police would do in a pub. And what they alleged they saw, they've said it was a thing/person related to a bikie gang, but we don't know what the thing or the person is. We don't know who that person is. I mean, is it something that was on the ground? Was it something attached on a wall? So you can see how if that sort of allegation was made in a criminal law context, well, obviously you would challenge that. You'd look at what are we talking about and if it's even relevant, because it might even be the case that it's totally irrelevant.
The rationale for using secret evidence, as yes. I understand it, and this is according to a statement I've received from the New South Wales Police Minister,
yes.
is that you need protections against the disclosure of criminal intelligence because
Absolutely.
The release of criminal intelligence may prejudice criminal investigations.
Yes.
They may enable the discovery of the existence or the identity of a confidential source of information relevant mm-hmm. to law enforcement, and you may well endanger a person's life or physical mm-hmm. safety.
Well, look, it's not common, but certainly even across civil litigation, there are instances of criminal intelligence information being given to parties under strict secrecy, providing you give it back. It's on a confidential basis. So this is why it's really unfair that in other systems, this secret evidence can be looked at. And we would suggest that in this...
Looked at by the lawyers.
Yes, absolutely. On that basis, that it is confidential, it can't be disclosed, et cetera, et cetera.
To your client.
Yes.
So you're telling me that if this was a criminal prosecution, mm-hmm. the rules around this sort of evidence would be quite different. It would be able
yes.
to be tested. But we know from a High Court decision a few years
yes.
ago that in civil cases, and I guess yours falls into this category,
yes.
that this is okay. The High Court has said the use of this kind of evidence on public policy grounds
yes.
is okay.
Yes, exactly. And that's a High Court decision, so virtually...
involving outlaw motorcycle gangs, I should point out.
It's
a Pompano case from Queensland.
Yes, exactly right. So went all the way to the High Court, was fought very hard. In that case, they looked at international law, which the High Court often does in making these sorts of decisions, and says that under certain circumstances, this actually can be allowed to protect the greater community, so to speak.
And that was a case involving whether or not a particular chapter of I think, the Finks motorcycle gang and a company called Pompano Proprietary Limited could be declared to constitute a criminal organisation, and the criminal evidence presented to that court to determine whether or not it was. So tell me, your client decided to appeal this decision?
Our client, primarily due to the fact that he's no longer working because he's not able to, he doesn't really have the funds to be able to make this appeal. So he's made the decision, and also based on the High Court reasoning, that perhaps it might be best if he doesn't appeal it.
Do you accept that outlaw motorcycle gangs should not be involved in the tattoo industry and we should take steps to get them out of the industry?
Well, it's really easy. I mean, I think, how different is the tattoo industry to any other shopfront industry? Kebab shops, news agents, convenience stores. It's really, I mean, if you put the spotlight on any industry as large as this, I don't think it would be any different. I would argue that they're really taking the wrong approach in trying to get rid of what they call organised crime and bikies.
Well, let me put to you a statement I received from Troy Grant, the New South Wales Police Minister. He said, quote, "The influence of outlaw motorcycle gangs in particular has ensured that tattoo parlours were associated with serious acts of violence, such as shootings and fire bombings. Yes. Tattoo parlours were also associated with the laundering of the proceeds of crime." End of quote. You know, I don't think anyone could deny that. I mean, all you just have to do is tap into your search engine. Shootings and tattoo shops, or bombings, or stabbings. You know, up comes a plethora of articles.
Absolutely.
At around 2 this morning, a tattoo parlour was raked with gunfire, and two men in balaclavas dropped a package on the doorstep.
Two men entered the Pretty in Ink tattoo parlour just before 10 o'clock. One of them had a gun
and fired one shot in the direction of Daniel Villa, striking him, and then fired a number of other shots into the shop indiscriminately.
Daniel Villa gave chase but collapsed on the pavement and died a short time later.
And two nearby tattoo parlours were also fired at.
We have a crisis on the streets of Western Sydney with a war going on, and people are scared.
Don't we need to take steps to reduce that link between organised crime and the tattoo industry?
Absolutely. But I mean, just going back to our client's scenario, he's never been involved in laundering proceeds of crime, and he's never been involved in any serious acts, and certainly not on those premises. So perhaps it involves a bit more of an analysis of the law. And I understand, as police already have quite extensive powers to deal with this issue anyway, by entering premises and listening devices and things like that. So by just outright banning a license of someone like our client, it doesn't really solve the problem, because the only thing that happens is these people then go underground and relatives start running the business and they're not qualified, et cetera, et cetera. So it's perhaps they're not working, you know.
Sydney lawyer Jeremy Maspero, partner with Maspero Legal. I did approach New South Wales Police Minister Troy Grant for an interview. He declined, but did provide a statement, which I referred to in my interview. I also approached New South Wales Police to discuss the complex policing and crime issues in the tattoo industry. They declined to speak. And I also approached New South Wales Fair Trading, who together with New South Wales Police run the licensing system. They also declined to speak, but did provide some stats. They tell me that under the 2012 legislation, there have been 233 operator licences accepted, 42 licences refused, and 6 cancelled. And when it comes to individual tattooist licences, there are 817 current licences, 62 have been refused, and 11 cancelled. Okay, so there are problems in the tattoo industry, but there are also very well-respected, long-standing tattoo businesses. So what do they think about the licensing system? Chris Rand and his family run Rand Family Tattoos in Windang on the New South Wales South Coast.
We have 3 generations at work in our studio, my daughter, with myself, my wife, and both my parents.
Now, in August this year, I understand the business won an award. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, we won Most Outstanding Specialised Business at the Local Business Awards for the Illawarra and South Coast region.
You won a very well-respected family business. It's in an industry where there are a lot of concerns about the presence of crime and violence. In response to those concerns, the state government a few years ago introduced a fit and proper person test for anyone applying for a business licence or even to work as a tattoo artist. What do you think of that fit and proper person test and the accompanying licensing process?
The fit and proper person test is a bit subjective. From the application that we've seen in the industry, it doesn't appear to be very consistent or very transparent. In regards to my own business, we're a family business, as we've stated before, so we've never been subjected to or involved in any of the elements that the government had put forward as justification for their licensing system.
You've had no problem getting your license, right?
No.
You jump through the hoops with flying colours. It's not a problem for you. But you have concerns about what you regard as the consistency and the fairness of this system. Why? What can you tell me about your concerns and maybe some of the cases that you're aware of?
Well, we've got a Facebook group that we formed for industry members so that we could have a united voice when discussing things with the government in terms of the legislative review process. Through that Facebook group, we've received many forms of feedback and polls, and members of the industry have been subjected to, for any practical example, one particular operator had applied for her license and has been fingerprinted approximately 4 times in the last 3 months, which is not really justifiable because fingerprints don't really change. So we're not sure why someone like that has been fingerprinted multiple times. Other people, when they've reapplied, haven't had to be fingerprinted at all because the amendment process removed the need for re-fingerprinting.
The state government has voiced its concerns about the involvement of organised crime in the industry. How prevalent is that presence?
From a personal point of view, I don't have any exposure to that. But what the feedback that we've had from our industry group is that all the members of our group have been fingerprinted and probity checked and have passed the fit and proper person test, and they're subjected to regular inspections whereby people who are operating outside of the system, where they are, say, tattooing from home, not participating in the licensing scheme or subsequently paying tax or abiding by health regulations, aren't subjected to any sort of form of inspection.
So you're saying that there's this licensing system, but it's not capturing everybody who's actually working in the industry. Is that what you're saying?
100%. It's actually, from feedback from our group, it has shown that there's been a bigger influx of backyard or illegal operators as opposed to what there was before the scheme. The ease with which people can buy tattoo supplies through the internet, through either eBay, Gumtree or other online sellers, it's an area that the government hasn't addressed yet.
You're a very highly educated man and you have a number of different qualifications, a number of different, if you like, career paths running in tangent. Has this process affected you in those endeavours at all?
Absolutely. In an initial third-party police check, I actually red flagged because my fingerprints and handprints are in the same database as people with a criminal history. That's spread then across to feedback that we've received from the industry where people have gone for loans, they've gone for rental properties, and the same thing in that initial red flagging process before a manual police check is then clears them. But when a decision needs to be made either on a career, on a rental property or something that needs to be done quickly, myself and the people within the industry who have passed the license scheme and now have our prints on file are at a disadvantage.
At a disadvantage in terms of getting bank loans, in terms of maybe job interview processes, those sorts of things?
Anything that involves that initial third-party police background check.
Chris Rand from Rand Family Tattoos in Windang on the New South Wales South Coast. I'm Damien Carrick and you're listening to The Law Report, broadcast on ABCRN, ABC News Radio and Radio Australia. Of course, you might be listening via podcast or via the ABC Listen app on your smartphone. While tattoo artists face hurdles here in Australia, in Japan, the only way you can legally tattoo a client is if you are a medical doctor. Late last month, a court in Osaka fined tattoo artist Taiki Masuda because, surprise, surprise, he is not a doctor. Stephen Krabs, senior lecturer in applied linguistics and translation, Japanese to English, at the University of Portsmouth in the UK, has closely followed this extraordinary case.
Well, Mr. Masuda is, or at least was until April 2015, a tattoo artist, an owner of a tattoo studio in an area of Japan called Osaka. Now, I say was, as he was hasn't actually worked as a tattoo artist since April 2015.
And that was because five plainclothed detectives raided his studio, confiscated his equipment and arrested him for tattooing three customers. Why did they do that?
Well, yes, indeed. Now, I should make clear that Mr. Masuda was not the only tattoo artist in Osaka to have their tattoo studio raided in 2015. And like all these other tattoo artists, he then appeared in the Osaka Summary Court, which I think is broadly equivalent in status to your magistrates or local court. And the Osaka Summary Court found him guilty of violating a Japanese law called the Medical Practitioners Act. Now, why? Well, it was because he tattooed the customers without having a medical practitioner's license, or in other words, without being a medical doctor. Now, he was ordered to pay a fine like the other tattoo artists, and in his case, it was 300,000 Japanese yen, which was about $3,250 Australian dollars at the time. However, he was the only tattoo artist who actually refused to pay this fine, and he opted instead for a full trial on the Osaka District Court, which is the next highest court after a summary court. And this trial is part of the reason I'm actually talking to you today.
Let's take a step back. You mentioned that there is this Medical Practitioners Act, which makes it an offence tattoo someone unless you're a doctor. It's been around since 2001, this provision of the Act. What's it all about?
In 2001, the permanent makeup industry had really started booming in Japan. And what I mean by that is permanent eyebrows, permanent lipstick. And in an attempt to regulate permanent makeup clinics, the Ministry of Health, Labour and Welfare issued a notice to health authorities across Japan. In this two-page notice, there is a line, and the line states that putting pigment on a needle tip and then inserting it into the skin constitutes a medical practice that can only be carried out by those with a medical practitioner's license, i.e. medical doctors. Now, until 2015, this notice was primarily used by health authorities across Japan in regulating permanent makeup clinics. But this changed in 2015 when the Osaka Prefectural Police started using the notice to arrest tattoo artists for violating the Medical Practitioners Act.
So Stephen Crabb, why was there this crackdown in 2015? Why was there this change of policy?
Well, the politician Toru Hashimoto was Osaka city mayor at this time, and he has been very open in his opposition to tattoos in Osaka. If I can give two brief examples of what I mean. First, in 2012, Mr. Hashimoto asked all Osaka City employees to complete a questionnaire declaring if and where they had a tattoo. He then suggested that those who did have a tattoo resign as they were not fit in his eyes to be municipal government employees. And the second example, and he is perhaps most well known outside Japan for this example. In the same year, 2012, he was asked by a reporter about Western tattooed celebrities. And Mr. Hashimoto responded that he wouldn't hire either Lady Gaga, the singer, or Johnny Depp, the actor, both of whom had recently been in Osaka. He wouldn't hire them as municipal government employees should they ever apply, because they both had tattoos.
So he has this long-standing animosity towards tattoos. Let's come back to the prosecution of a tattoo artist, Taiki Masuda. He declined to pay the fine back in 2015. So he had to go to the full trial, and that was in April. And just in late September, the decision of the court was handed down. What did the court rule?
The presiding judge stated that it was reasonable. In other words, not too heavy a burden, as the defense had argued, to require tattoo artists to hold a medical practitioner's license, i.e. to be a qualified medical doctor, to prevent possible health risks from tattooing. Mr. Masuda's fine was set this time at 150,000 Japanese yen, which is about 1,700 Australian dollars.
What are the big picture implications of this ruling upholding this law, which had until recent times been largely ignored?
If judicial and police authorities across Japan do follow Osaka in requiring tattoo artists to have a medical practitioner's license, then it is likely that increasing numbers of tattoo artists in Japan will be charged with the same crime. And I imagine that this would lead many to give up tattooing, possibly go underground, or even go abroad to seek work as tattoo artists.
Of course, Japan has a long tradition of tattoo art. I think going back to the 17th century, tattoos were used to punish criminals, and dragon tattoos were also used by firefighters as kind of talismans to kind of protect them against fire. But of course, as I understand it, there's a big association of tattoos with organised criminals, namely the Yakuza.
Yes, particularly full body tattoos or full back tattoos with Japanese motifs are associated with organized crime groups such as the Yakuza. Although, interestingly, anecdotally, I have heard that recently younger Yakuza members are now less likely to get tattoos in an attempt to blend in with standard Japanese business practices.
I understand that people with tattoos are banned from swimming pools and hot springs and some beaches.
Yes, if, for example, you travel to Japan at some point in the future, you are fairly likely to see signs at swimming pools, hot springs, gyms, or even some beaches banning people with tattoos. There's in fact even a Japanese website called Tattoo Spot that lists recreational spots, including hot springs, swimming pools, and gyms, that allow tattoos and won't make visitors cover them up.
Oh boy, imagine a business here in Australia rejecting all tattooed customers. That's Stephen Krebs, Senior Lecturer in Applied Linguistics and Translation at the University of Portsmouth, speaking with me via Skype. And Stephen reckons it's quite likely that this case will go all the way up to Japan's Supreme Court. That's the Law Report for this week. Big thanks to producer Anita Barrow and technical producer Melissa May. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next week with more Law.